Hello and thanks for joining us for this week's Big Boat interview. In this episode, I caught up with Alfie Best. Alfie is number 232 on the Times Rich List and calls himself Britain's wealthiest Romany gypsy. He also owns a Sunseeker, Wildcrest, and is planning on buying more yachts to capitalise on what he sees as a gap in the charter market for smaller and more affordable boats. In this exclusive interview, he discusses how he's made his fortune, why he doesn't think the boom in the yachting market will continue, warns of a recession, and talks about what it's like being an entrepreneur who's never able to switch off. So I thought we'd start at the very beginning, beginning of the story before we get onto the boat, which is obviously why we're here. And when West Nautical suggested that I might like to interview you, they said, oh, you know, do you want to interview Alfie? He's the owner of Wildcrest and he's Britain's richest gypsy. And when I started doing my kind of Googling for my research, that's what came up a lot. You know, there are all these headlines saying Britain's richest gypsy or billionaire gypsy and stuff like that. So my first question was just, I wondered how you felt about that. Is it something that you're very proud about? Or do you kind of think, you know, if I was a normal billionaire, no one would mention that. So why bring it up? How do you feel?
Everybody wants to, you know, put a tag on something for what they're saying.
Mm.
So it doesn't water for duck's back. It doesn't make, you know, I see it for what it is.
Yeah.
If it's perceived as something, some people would say it potentially could help them.
Mm-hmm.
Other people would say it's, you know, why say it?
But yeah.
So no, it doesn't make a blind bit of difference to me, to be fair.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. And then let's sort of start a bit talking about your background and your kind of backstory. So I know a bit of this from looking up, but people listening won't. Tell me a bit about your childhood, where you grew up, how you got into this line of work, that sort of thing.
Okay, my name's Alfie Best. I was born in a place called Lutterworth. And, you know, I come from a gypsy background. My mum and dad were hard-working people. My dad was like a door-to-door, you know, odd job man.
Mm-hmm.
My mum, you know, she sort of stayed at home and looked after, you know, at the time the caravan, and she would clean. You know, what a lot of people don't realise, when gypsies were travelling up and down the road, one of the reasons that the women stayed at home wasn't just because they had to be a housewife. It was to actually protect their goods.
Yeah.
Because they were pulled on the side of the road.
Mm.
Okay, you don't see it quite as much now as what you used to see, you know, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
But, and I say 50 years, 50 years sounds so long, but yeah, it's actually like yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, it's a short passage of time. And then, you know, from that point, I worked with my dad up until the age of 14.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had periodic schooling. And so, you know, somebody said to me, how can you say that you're still a gypsy?
Yeah. When you say gypsy, do you mean, because people have different definitions of that, so you're a Romany gypsy or?
I'm a Romany gypsy.
Mm-hmm.
So to be fair, it's as simple as this. Just because a dog is born in a stable, it doesn't make it a horse.
Yeah.
And just because the horse is born in the field doesn't make it a cow.
Yeah.
So we are what we are.
Yeah.
And for anybody to deny their own heritage, which I don't think nobody does, except for the gypsy culture.
Really?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
It comes with a stigma. And with that stigma, you know, there's a stereotype. And that stereotype comes with it. So, you know, you're not going to openly state that you're a gypsy when you're in business because it comes with that stereotype. It comes with that stigma.
And do you feel that's still as strong as ever? Do you feel like that's kind of getting better in any way? Or do you feel like, you know, it's you get the same reaction as you would have done 20 years ago?
Do I think it's getting better? I think it's got worse.
Really?
Yeah. I don't. Not 3 days ago did I receive a load of abuse openly on Instagram.
Mm.
Yesterday I was looking at something that was printed on Facebook. The son of asked me to do a business column on business advice.
Mm.
And the abuse that I've seen on there, and I thought to myself, I thought, and it's like water off a duck's back. It really doesn't faze me in any way, face or shape or form. But so, if anything, it's the last acceptable racism that's out there.
Yeah.
Now, I don't class it as racism.
Mm.
I class it just as abuse.
Yeah.
But it's the last acceptable abuse. So I don't take anything from it. I just see it for what it is.
Mm.
There are some very shallow people out there.
Yeah.
There's some.
And so in your business, well, so you kind of, you know, you said you had intermittent schooling and that's your kind of background. And now you have this business, Wildcrest Parks, which is incredibly successful. Can you talk a bit about what you do and how you got into that and where the kind of business is going today?
Wildcrest Parks is the largest residential park home operator in Europe. We currently have in excess of 100 parks. By the end of the year, we'll be at 108 parks with 16,000 residents in the UK. And when we started this business with a passion. And it was a real passion because I understand better than most how a caravan works, whether it's a good one, whether it's a bad one, what the construction's like, whether it, you know, I know that better than most.
When did you stop living in a caravan, or do you still have one now?
Well, I live in caravans all the time
because
I visit all my parks and I always stay on all of my parks.
Yeah.
But currently I live in a house.
Yeah.
But when did I actually physically, I suppose about the age of 18?
Yeah.
Something like that. But caravans are in my blood.
Mm.
I'd still live on one of my parks today because I lived on one of my first park I bought, I lived on.
Yeah.
That was in Romford. I lived on it for nearly 8 years.
Yeah.
The only reason I don't live on my parks now is because I work 16 and 17 hour days every day.
Yeah.
Gosh. Not could be, not would be. No, not really, gosh.
No. That sounds quite tiring to me. You don't look that tired.
Well, let me just say this to you. Not really, and I'll tell you why. Because I'm not working.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying what I'm doing. That's like saying to a footballer, did you not enjoy that game?
Mm.
He loves playing football.
Yeah.
It might be the odd game that he doesn't like, X, Y, Z, but the truth of the matter is he loves football. But that's his job.
Yeah.
No different than park homes are my job.
Mm.
And I see park homes as the solution, as affordable housing in the UK. You know, I can sell you a park home bungalow for 50% of a like-for-like park home of the bricks and mortar for 50% less.
Yeah.
From band A, council tax.
Yeah.
As opposed to band B, C and D.
Yeah.
So it's the cheapest, no land registration fee, no stamp duty.
Mm.
The electricity through the commercial meter is 28% less.
And are you selling these to people from all different walks of life, or is it still, are you kind of focusing on gypsy communities, or who's buying them?
99% of our customers are semi-retired and retired from the non-gypsy community.
Yeah.
You know, this is gypsies, unfortunately, are so stereotyped. It's the encampments that you see that the council build. It's illegal to live on that site if you're not a gypsy.
Oh, really?
Legalised segregation.
Mm.
So, no, gypsies don't live on our parks.
Yeah. And I feel like there's so much to discuss business-wise, but I want to bring in your boat here because people will be listening to it thinking, you know, what's this got to do with yachting? Yeah, exactly. So this is all sounds, you know, everything about what you've talked about is land-based and is caravan-based. So what made you want to buy a boat? And is there a kind of gypsy tradition of yachting? I don't know anything about kind of the relationship with the water and the sea. Is it a personal thing? Is it a kind of community thing?
Not at all, I don't think. No.
Mm.
Gypsies are nomadic people. And with yachts, they give you a sense of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had boats before.
Yeah.
I had a yacht before called Marna,
A sailing or a motor yacht?
No, motor yacht.
Yeah.
And this is the second yacht that we've bought. And we really have gone the extra mile with this.
Mm-hmm.
I've reset it up with brand new jet skis, brand new Sea-Doos. I've just put on there a brand new jet pack, you know, like the water jet mm-hmm. pack.
Yeah.
And I did that because I wanted to create, on a yacht of this size, I wanted to create a super yacht at an affordable level
yeah.
for a lot of people. Because I looked at this as a business.
Mm-hmm.
And yachts seem to jump up in price. And it is expensive
yeah.
to do yachting. So I looked at this as a business, as I do with everything.
Yeah.
And I thought, what I liked about this was this particular yacht, which is a Sunseeker 90, is a 7.6 meter berth, draft. So you can't, when this boat is anchored, you cannot tell the difference between a 165 footer and a 90 footer, which is really unusual. But what's even better about is when you're at sea or you're anchored, the afterdeck is electric and motorized. So not only will it drop out, it comes out with a full extended beach tub.
Yeah.
And
which is such a big thing now for people chartering massive. And stuff as well. Yeah.
When I went on this year, I spent so much time with the beach deck. You know, that's where we stood. We had the barbecue there with the electric seats come down with the umbrellas. And that's pretty well where we spent most of the time. So on a yacht of this size, to have that, and because it's electric, it's like having a 120-footer. So we've managed to create a yacht with the toys that we've put on there. I've put the jetpack. I've put the out-part swimming pool with the net. It mm-hmm. blows up. We've put everything on there.
Yeah.
That you, if you pulled up the side, you'd think it was 140 footer with the toys we've put on.
Yeah.
And the way the electric deck beach club comes out really has added so much to it.
Yeah.
And
how did you come to buy her? Were you looking around for a long time? Did you know that you wanted a Sunseeker or you knew that you wanted a smaller yacht?
It took me, originally, I was looking for a 120-footer.
Mm-hmm.
So, but when I was then invited down to look at this, I was absolutely blown away at the size that they've utilised. And when I could see the electric platform and the beach club coming out, that sold it for me.
Yeah.
Because what it gave you was your complete dining area, because the seats fold back up. You have to see it. We're talking, obviously, visually is different.
Yeah.
And we branded the yacht and named it Wildcrest.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Wildcrest is so fitting to the sea, because it's wild, as in wild, crest, as in crest of the wave.
And yeah.
Actually, it means something completely different. Because our name of our company is called Wildcrest.
Yeah.
But it's great PR and great advertising for us as well.
And you've spent quite a lot of time on board, it sounds like. Kind of, where have you been with her? What have you done? What does the perfect day on board look like for you as a kind of yacht owner?
I think beauty that I found, and I was over the moon with size. That was the most important thing, that it gave you fantastic living as well as entertaining space. And this certain Wildcrest certainly has. But what we did was we left Mallorca, motored to Ibiza, and then from Ibiza we went to Alicante, and then went all the way down to Port Benos. Then came back up, and then we went to the south of France.
And was this as a family or friends or a bit of both?
Me and my son.
Yeah.
What it did is it allowed us the time together to talk about things that we wouldn't normally talk about.
Yeah.
You know, like, what I would say what a yacht does is this, and I never knew this before. The times when we used to go home and have family dinners seem to be non-existent now in the culture that we live in.
Yeah.
That's what a yacht does for you. As well as waking up the next morning in some beautiful cove that, you know, you look up into the mountains, the restaurant up there, and then you set the yacht up for the day. You know, it is spectacular. I've got to say, I've got a jet and I've got a helicopter. And they were phenomenal experiences. They're, you know, I can only say that a yacht is tenfold better of an experience.
Really, that's interesting. Yeah. It's interesting that you comment on that, because a lot of people say, you know, especially I've heard it a lot recently after the pandemic, with lots of people going with their families on board. And when I was at this thing with the University of Monaco the other day, the researchers there were saying, you know, what people value is the experience. And what people said time and time again in their research was, you know, it cost me this much to get there. It cost me this much to charter the boat. It cost me this much to redo my boat to be there. But the 2 weeks I had on board with my son is something that's priceless. And the conversations we had and the time we spent together, you know, just chatting about whatever, is something that you can't replicate or make happen in any other way. So that's, it's interesting you found that.
What it does is confines you, but it doesn't imprison you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely, because you can move around, but you're kind of together in the same space. Yeah.
And because what I did find, and why I made sure that Wildcrest, after the first week of me being on it, had every time, from the swimming pool that inflates out into the sea to the jetpack, was what I realised is you want to come back to something new.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
And look, there's for instance, there's a wakeboard on there. Now, I can't wakeboard, but it didn't stop me trying.
Yeah.
But after a while, when you can't do it, and you're getting better at it bit by bit, you want to go and try something else because it's a bit demoralising.
Yeah.
That makes sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what I promised myself is I'll go and have lessons.
Yeah, really. And is that your kind of yachting then? Like lots of water sports, out and about on land, restaurants and that kind of thing? Yeah. Or is it more kind of chilled out?
No. I'm not a sunbather.
No.
So it's important for me. One of the best days that we did was waking up the next day in a cove where there was four or five other yachts and the yacht being set up. I found that absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
That like just waking up in a place that you couldn't get to any other way.
Yeah.
Is it expensive? Yeah, it's very expensive. What we genuinely try to do is create a brand new yacht with everything that you'd want at a reasonable level in comparison to yachting.
Yeah. And how did the sale go? I'm not quite sure who owned it before, but was it pretty straightforward or were there other parties kind of trying to buy it?
Look, what I would say to you is with, at the moment, it's a seller's market. And we're in a buoyant climate. So, you know, it's always difficult when you're trying to buy a yacht, especially in a buoyant market. And especially with an award-winning new design.
Yeah.
Because people want that design, but they don't want to wait for it.
Yeah.
That makes sense?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
That causes a bit, a few problems.
Mm.
But, you know, nothing is easy.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever had any simple deal. Lawyers are involved. It's never simple. But
so you got there.
But we got there. I think all the people around me tried hard to help. And got the job done.
And then, so is your plans to charter her and sell her, or just both?
You know, look, everything that I do in my life is about creating value. So we will, the yacht is up for charter now, and we will continue to charter it. And I think that we've created a business model that other people will copy because it's expensive. But it's about half the price of something the same, similar, if you measured the beach club extended.
Yeah.
When it's out. So, like, to me, I think there's a real niche there.
Is that how you've managed to make it cheaper then? Because owners will be listening to this thinking, well, I want to charter my yacht for half as much and have it chartered all the time. So you put it down, the lower cost down to the fact you've got this beach club which opens up and makes more space.
On a 90-foot, they don't come with beach clubs. The closest you can get to a beach club is 125-foot plus.
Mm.
So to have an electrical extended platform that comes out that gives you all of that, and I can still charter this for €80,000 a week.
Mm-hmm.
You'd normally be paying €125,000 plus to get the same facilities,
right?
If you wanted the 125 plus,
yeah.
So yeah, I do. I think that's a massive saving.
Yeah, and how's it going? You know, have you got charter bookings booked up from now until forever, or are you just at the beginning?
We've only just started with the chartering.
Mm-hmm.
And already we've got 6 weeks booked.
Yeah.
Which I think is phenomenal considering you're starting with something fresh.
Yeah, completely.
So I think that shows the model works.
Mm.
And I think the more feedback we get from people that's coming out there, which we will put back out there so people can see, and word of mouth in business is everything.
Yeah.
I think we will have a lot of repeat customers. And I think that we will grow this. The reason that we've put the yacht up for sale was we're testing the market.
Yeah. And if someone came through the door, you know, I've had crazy stories from owner. If I said, you know, all right, I'll buy it. How would you actually feel about that? Would there be a part of you that thinks, oh, I've just got it? Or would you be genuinely happy that that's off?
Let me say this to you. I come from a background which is a little bit superstitious. So the reason that I have everything for sale is because we are not the owners of anything. And we should be passing on with good luck.
Okay.
Do you understand?
Yeah.
So what you're doing is creating, you're passing everything on, whether it be land, whether it be houses, whether it be cars, whether it be boats, whether it be helicopters. Even my helicopter is for sale.
Yeah.
Everything is for sale. The reason being, we're here to maintain it and pass it on for everybody else to enjoy. In life, it should be a circle.
Yeah.
It should be a complete circle. We only lease things in life. We never own them. We're the caretakers. And we should be prepared to pass on good luck down the line.
And can you see yourself kind of, you know, if this model takes off how you're kind of hoping it will, can you see yourself having multiple yachts and 100%. Having a big fleet and that sort of thing?
100%.
Mm.
That's what we will be doing.
Yeah.
That's what I would like to be doing.
So are you kind of on the hunt or kind of ear to the ground slightly
we're still looking now.
And what are you looking for now? Something similar, something bigger, but with the same kind of vibe?
I love the model.
Yeah.
I really love the model. I think we're going to be lucky if we can find one.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to be looking to order a new yacht, same thing, to add to this anyway.
Yeah.
Because I think the list to order yachts is actually going to get longer.
Yeah.
Not shorter. Even though I think we're heading into, you know, rough times.
Yeah.
I think we're heading for a recession.
Yeah.
The reason that I still think we're going to have cars, helicopters and yachts in short supply is they can't get the parts.
Yeah.
And if you can't get the parts, who ever thought we'd be going through COVID and then a war where we need certain materials that I think is 80% comes from that, what they use in the microchips.
Yeah.
Comes from the Ukraine.
Yeah. Well, I know from our kind of, you know, we have lots of data and we have very good relationships with the shipyards, and it's also just the capacity. Like, the you know, if their order books are full, there's only so many boats they can build in there. Sheds, and of course, if one of them goes bust or if a number of them, I have terrible flashbacks to, I wrote this piece about yachts that were kind of built but never sailed, and lots of them came out of the crash of 2008 when a lot of shipyards went bust. But it's interesting you think a recession is kind of on the way, because there's concern in yachting. Some people say, you know, we're not sort of touched by this. Other people say, oh, the bubble's going to burst at some point. So what makes you say that, and what's your feeling and how things are going to go?
I'm shocked that you wrote about the 2008 recession.
Yeah.
That was a hard recession.
Yeah.
But the 1990 recession was worse.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah, that was a lot worse.
Was that worse for you personally in terms of your businesses bankrupt. And things? Yeah.
I nearly went bankrupt. In 1990, I nearly went bankrupt. I was living in the back of an escort van with a mattress.
Yeah, really?
Yeah. So, but the 2008 was bad, you know. That was a recession that was quite good to us. Recessions are corrections in the market. We'll have them all the time. And, you know, this one is going to be a difficult one, in my opinion, because we've got many factors. Interest rates are very low at this moment, even at the, where they are and they've put them up to. Worldwide, they're low. The problem with that is this. If interest rates go from 1% to 2%, it's really a small increase. It's 1%. It's nothing. But in the monetary terms of currency, it's a fortune.
Yeah.
Because what it does is doubles your mortgage repayment.
Yeah.
Do you follow me?
Yeah, yeah, completely.
So that can hurt me.
But do you think it will affect yachting? You know, the kind of people that charter yachts for, you know, 100 grand or whatever it is. Do you think that will then cause them to pull back a bit?
Let's put it this way. Recessions affect everybody. Recessions affect everybody. It's just where you're placed in the market. And it's not, you know, and people say, oh, it's never going to affect me because I've got X. When the flow of money stops coming, money is like water.
Yeah.
You'll get thirsty if you don't drink enough. And if there isn't enough to go round, it doesn't matter how much you've got, you keep taking a cup full out of the sea will go dry. It depends how hard it hits.
And so you mentioned you were kind of hit badly by the recession before. How do you feel, you know, the likelihood of one coming up again? Are you doing stuff to kind of, you know, bulletproof your business? Are you very nervous about it? What's your kind of approach?
I'm not nervous about it.
I
personally foresee it. And I think that we are heading for a correction.
Yeah.
No question about it. Am I doing anything and do I think it's going to affect the yacht? Yeah. But that's why exactly why I've set this type of yacht up with the business that I've done.
Yeah.
Because people will make corrections. And all of a sudden, if they feel they can get virtually the same type of value for a little bit less, or sorry, for a lot less,
yeah,
but the same type of value,
yeah,
then hold on, they're going to be jumping.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. We definitely have seen more movement in this kind of smaller end of the market, largely as well, just in terms of where people can travel and the kind of freedom of having 100%. having a smaller boat. You know, that plays into it as well, I think.
But there is also a little bit of snobbery around it.
Yeah.
When you pull up or when you dock up in your berth, you still want to look like you've got a super yacht.
Yeah.
And that's why this yacht, because it's a 7.6 metre berth.
Yeah.
So we were next to a 100 in Marbella. We were next to a 135 foot. And we looked like we were the bigger boat.
Really?
Where we were.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
And how have you found the yachting community? Because different people have different experiences. Some people like to kind of network a lot and hang out in, you know, Sunseeker clubs and things like that. Some people are happy just doing their own thing. How have you found it?
Pretty much I do my own thing.
Yeah.
You know, if I bump into somebody, I'm polite and courteous and all that, but I can't say that I go out specifically to mix with people that are out within the yachting industry.
Yeah.
You know, I think good people are good people no matter where they're from.
Yeah.
Or they're bad people.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what you are or where you're from. It's the person inside that makes a lot of difference, isn't it?
And you mentioned earlier that the design of the yacht caused you a few kind of headaches. Can you expand a bit about that? You know, why was that a bit of a sticky point?
Well, look, when you've got, when you're looking for 120 foot plus and then you look at a 90 foot, there, you think to yourself, hold on, is that going to work? So, and also when you've then got to deal with yachting with electric platforms dip below the water, they can cause you issues in the mind as well, because you're thinking, hold on, what happens if this breaks at sea? But what we then saw is looked at how you could deal with it manually.
Yeah.
Do you follow me?
Yeah.
And Once you're au fait with all of that and the crew is okay with it, and I will say this to you, I've been very lucky in what I believe finding a good crew.
Oh, definitely. So how did you find your crew then?
We found them through West Nautical. West Nautical are our management company. I can't speak highly enough about them. Jeff has been spot on. Mike has gone above and beyond to teach me how yachting works, how it doesn't. And they've been more than helpful. They've gone above and beyond. And this is not me giving them a plug. This is me giving customer feedback where they have gone above and beyond. Also, our solicitors, Jaffa and Co., were brilliant.
Yeah.
They held our hand all the way through it. You know, there were some teething problems and issues that we had to deal with, and they dealt with them for us. And what I can say to you is they dealt with it always in a professional way. But what the good thing is, the owner of the company, of the solicitors' company, was on hand at all times.
Really?
Well, I can't speak highly enough of
it. Yeah, it sounds amazing. So you might buy more Sunseekers like that in the future, or kind of put yourself on the list for one.
Look, the beauty of Sunseeker, you're buying a known, quantified brand. Their after sales is impeccable, and they've got pedigree.
Mm.
So you know the value of your yacht is always there.
Yeah.
That makes a big difference. No different than going in and buying, a bespoke tailor-made suit.
Yeah.
You know, you go to somewhere in Savile Row, you know that you're getting a quality suit made by a quality manufacturer. Well, that's not what suits are, but you understand what I'm saying. That, I think, is a big thing in yachting.
And how do you deal with, you know, this has only just occurred to me, but if you've kind of not really chartered before, and I don't know if you did charter your yachts before or not, but, you know, lots of people say the difficult part is not the boat, it's dealing with the guests and, you know, the charter guests. Like, how do you find that aspect of things? Is it something that you just leave West Nautical to deal with, or are you quite hands-on in terms of liaising with the company?
I haven't had enough feedback from that, but I'm a very customer-orientated person.
Yeah.
So I want people to have a good time. I want them to be happy. I want them to, you know, have the experience of a lifetime. And you're not going to please everybody with everything.
Yeah.
It's an impossibility. But you can keep trying.
Yeah.
And as long as you're trying and people can see you're trying, most people are not prima donnas.
Yeah.
Most people are not.
Yeah, that's an interesting
thing. That's my view.
We'll see. You can report back in a year or so and see if you've had some bad ones. But that's interesting. And then of your kind of business life, because you've obviously been incredibly successful, you know, what are the best lessons that people have taught you? What do you kind of always have in the back of your mind that's shaped how you operate today?
Never assume anything by what you're told. Check it.
That's interesting.
Never ask anybody to trust you.
Mm.
Because if you ask people to trust you, they will accept everything that you say is right because you're telling them to trust you.
Mm.
What you should be saying is, don't trust me.
Well, as in, do your own research, find out for yourself if that you're happy to do it.
If I tell you to do something, don't just take my word for it.
Yeah.
Check. Do you know when people do this for me, I seem to make less mistakes.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
because the onus is on them, I guess, to actually, you know.
As opposed to the onus being on you and always getting it right.
Yeah.
I have a fantastic team around me.
Yeah.
Because they check.
Yeah.
They don't just accept my word for everything I say. They check.
And how do you get that fantastic team? Because that sounds like an easy thing to do, but, a lot of business owners around the world are kind of struggling to get the right people around them to make their businesses work.
I personally think the reason for that is because they're looking for people to work for them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not. I'm looking for people to work with me.
Yeah.
There's a difference.
And do you think you're good at, you know, if you interview someone, do you think you have an innate sense of if it's going to work out or not? Or are there some people that you think, you know what, that didn't work out? You know, that's one of the people that's joined the company that's now going to leave.
I think I'm a terrible person at interviewing people, but I'm a fantastic person at reading people. So would I say that I have an innate amount of questions? And the answer is no. It's sort of when I go into an interview, I want to know about the person, what their goals are. Qualifications are great, but determination is fantastic. And that's what I like to see in people. People that will go the extra mile.
Yeah.
People that are not clock watchers looking to get out the door. That tells me somebody doesn't like what they do.
Yeah.
I want somebody that doesn't want to leave because they love it so much.
Yeah.
I want them to believe in what we're doing. And yachting is no different.
Yeah.
I want the team on WildQuest to act as a team for the benefit of the guests.
Yeah. And, yeah, I think you're right that you're incredibly lucky to have a great crew because that's not easy to come by at all.
They make or break.
Mm.
But I think it's also important for the crew to know what the goals are.
And what are the goals? What have you kind of briefed them as?
To provide the best experience possible. And if there is a failure, admit the failure. But a failure is never a failure until the bottom line.
Yeah.
So you must always look to put it right without the knowledge of the guest knowing. Because they don't need to know
that
there is a problem.
Yeah.
They just need to know that you solved it.
Yeah. And had you been on many charter yachts yourself before having WildQuest?
No.
So you've not, it's not like you've been on charters where you feel you had bad guest experiences on other boats or anything like
charters,
that?
The only charters that I've been on have tended to have been day charters where I've been invited. And on those types of charters, I found that crew seemed to be terrified of how the guests were because they were party boats.
I
tend to watch people.
Yeah.
And everybody loves a yacht. But the trouble is a lot of people don't realise it is expensive.
Yeah.
It is not cheap to run a yacht, to charter a yacht, and they cost millions and millions of pounds.
And do you worry about that with WildQuest? Do you worry about how people might treat it or behave when they're on board?
Well, the crew that's on there have a job as an inventory to score the boat when the customer comes on and when they leave. So what they think they could have done better.
Yeah, okay.
And also to go through the yacht, chapter and verse, for any dinks, donks, chips, and put them right.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier, you know, you were saying you work incredibly long days and you were saying your dad was very hardworking. Do you think you've learnt much from him in terms of business and the way you work?
My dad's my idol.
Mm.
My dad is 77 years old. And still works 7 days a week.
Really?
Manually.
Crikey.
Manually. He's a Trojan.
Yeah.
Just an absolute Trojan.
And where do you think that kind of ethic comes from? You know, what's behind it?
Work ethic is nothing more than habit.
Mm.
We can all become lazy.
Yeah.
We can all become hard workers. It's about getting into a habit.
Mm.
And once that habit kicks in, you can either increase it or decrease it.
Yeah.
I've chosen my habits. I've chosen my habits at work.
Yeah.
I love what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I have a passion for it. I love affordable housing. I love changing people's lives. And I love looking at different businesses to see where the pinch points are,
mm-hmm.
to see where the problems are.
Yeah.
And that's where why I think we're going to score big with WildQuest.
Yeah, yeah. And do you find it, you know, do you find it difficult to switch off somewhat? If you're kind of, you know, you love what you do and you love working, but everyone needs a break sometimes. Do you find it hard to to make yourself step away?
Extremely.
Really?
Extremely.
What helps you do it?
I don't think I ever do.
Yeah.
I still have my PC with me. I still have my, you know, my phone and my emails going constantly. Mm. I never, ever turn them off.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I don't think I ever do. But I try to take the time out as much as I can.
Yeah. Does it bother you? Or do you think, you know what, I'm quite happy working this many hours a day. You know, I don't need 1,000 hobbies and long holidays in the Caribbean to be happy. I'm happy as I am.
I think I'm very happy the way I am. But it's that work that's allowed me the joys that I had so far.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, you know, I've been asked once, does money make you happy? My reply to that is try being without it and try being with it.
Yeah.
See if you're smiling at each end.
Yeah.
And the trouble is you tend to smile with it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And does it, you know, does it feel like a very different life you're living now to the way you grew up or not really?
Okay. If you ask me now and you ask me then, the answer is yes, of course.
Mm.
But it's been gradual.
Mm.
It wasn't an overnight success that went boom. It's taken 35 years.
Yeah.
So the 35 years has been gradual, bit by bit by bit. So it doesn't feel any different. But if I look back and think of today and then think of a moment then, it is a massive, you know, it's worlds apart.
Yeah. And that never seems, you never have moments where you kind of think, it's weird that I'm here in my helicopter. You know, I never imagined myself doing that.
There have been times when I've been on my own that I've sort of wondered how I got here.
Yeah. And how do you think you got there?
Well, the lottery. It was a rollover treble. No. I think there's definitely a certain amount of luck. I think we all need that in life. But most of it was through hard work.
Yeah.
Just sheer grit, hard work, blood, blisters and tears.
And do you hope that your son and your family will kind of take that on and take on the business and things like that? Or do you think, no, you know, I'm not going to tell them how to lead their own path?
Many people have used, coined this phrase, and I'll try and shorten it as much as I can for you.
Okay.
The last person that said it impressed me the most, which was Sheikh Mukhtar. And he said, my great-grandfather rode a camel. My grandfather drove a Land Rover. My father drove a Range Rover. I drive a Rolls Royce. My son will drive a Rolls Royce. My grandson will drive a Mercedes. My great-grandson will drive a Land Rover. My great-great-grandson will ride a camel. And he said, good times inspire weakness. Bad times inspire greatness.
Mm.
And Britain was the greatest country in the world. We don't seem to be heading that way so much. And we are a great country.
Yeah.
And do you know what fathomed it to me?
Mm.
Is when I saw Jeremy Corbyn arguing in Parliament with Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
In our darkest hour. And that was to do with Brexit. And if at one time since the war that the two heads of the main party should have come together, it was them.
Yeah.
You know, to look, this is what we voted on. Let's get through this the best way we can and come out of Europe for Britain in the best format. But Jeremy Corbyn was trying to win score points. I'm not sure if it was him, it would have been somebody else.
Mm.
But, you know, had to go through two prime ministers because they all got given the poison chalice.
Mm.
Do I think it was the right thing to come out of Europe? No, not really.
Mm.
But once the vote had been made, once our country had decided and our people had voted on it, let's get on with it.
Yeah.
But they didn't. And it made me realise at that time our greatest hour of greatness has long passed.
Yeah.
Because we have a party that's two-party leaders. And I actually voted for Tony Blair because I don't tend to vote parties. I vote for who the person is.
Yeah.
I think they're the right man for the job.
Yeah.
And Jeremy Corbyn, to be fair, I thought it was a laughing stock, to be brutally blunt. He reminded me of Michael Foot. If you have a leader, you have a leader.
Yeah.
A powerful man that's not afraid to speak his mind and speak up and doesn't back down. Not some feeble dweeb. And that's how I see it.
Yeah.
Because I would have thought so much more of Corbyn.
Yeah.
If he would have said, do you know, this is a time our country needs to unite.
Mm.
And I'm not going to be concerned about scoring some points. I'm going to be going, right, let's sit down.
Yeah.
And let me help you. But instead, they all wanted to go and have a bun fight in Parliament.
Yeah.
Score some points. And I just...
And how do you feel about staying in the UK then? Because there are lots of, you know, owners with yachts and properties all over the world that are saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to move to the States or I'm going to move to the Caribbean. You know, is that something you can ever see yourself doing or are you here for the long haul?
I would love to stay in the UK. But this country makes it so difficult for successful people to stay.
Mm.
What they do is reward people to come in. But they chase the wealth out.
Yeah. Do you feel that as someone who has?
Yeah.
Well,
I do.
Yeah.
I have options all over the world to move all over the world, and I will.
Yeah.
There's no question about it.
Really?
Yeah.
What kind of places do you have in mind as I can see myself there?
US, we're definitely going to be setting up and operating further businesses there.
Mm.
But I will either go to Monaco or Dubai,
yeah,
or somewhere that's more tax efficient for me as a person.
Yeah.
People, you know, want to coin the phrase that you should be pleased to pay your taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I am. What I'm not pleased to do is to pay taxes. I shouldn't have to pay when they have other individuals. What, it should be one rule for everybody.
Yeah.
Not one rule for one and one rule for another.
Yeah.
I don't accept that.
Yeah. So how do you, and maybe this is, you can say if this is too personal a question, but in terms of spending money for fun, what things do you really actually enjoy spending money on just for you as, you know, your hard-earned cash? This is something you really look forward to doing.
Alcohol, drugs, sex, rock and roll. actually, nothing.
Really?
I swear to you, that's not a hollow answer.
Yeah.
I swear to you, nothing.
Yeah.
I'm not. My fun is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I'm frightened not to do it.
Yeah.
I'm frightened not to do it.
Yeah.
Because if I don't want to go back to sleeping in the back of an escort van.
Yeah. And do you worry about retiring and things? Yeah, well,
I'll never retire.
Never.
Look, I may retire for a while, but to take that break to re-engage myself.
Mm.
But I don't think that I'll ever retire.
Yeah. And, you've referenced a couple of times this kind of sleeping in the back of a van thing. Was that really the reality of it? And how did you kind of... Yeah. Pull yourself out of it.
Yeah, yeah. When I think about it, the chills come up. I had a mattress in the back of an escort van, and I slept in the back of the escort van. Slept in there for three to six months.
And so, yeah, then how did you kind of, so obviously that was because you'd just gone bankrupt?
No. I was virtually bankrupt. I was bankrupt.
Yeah.
But I never officially got made bankrupt.
Yeah.
I had a house that was worth $550,000 that I bought. I had a mortgage on it for $250,000. It collapsed to a price of $200,000.
Yeah. Gosh.
So now
yeah.
I owed the bank more than the property was worth.
Yeah.
That was the 1990 recession. I had a block of flats that was, I think, five or six flats, whatever it was, I think, you know, were worth $400,000. I had a mortgage of $225,000. They dropped to a value of
$175,000.
Mm. So now I'm paying out that. But I managed, the thing that saved me, and I didn't realise it saved me at the time, was a thing called negative equity.
Mm-hmm.
And because they owed more, it wasn't worth the bank repossessing them.
Yeah.
So as long as I paid the mortgages and I scrimped and I scraped and I moved out of the house, moved in the back of the escort van and rented the house.
And did you have your family then, or was that when you were still living on your own? Yeah.
I'd just gone through a divorce.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, that sounds like an incredibly difficult time, but amazing to have, you know, hung on in there.
Accept what's thrown us. Accept what's thrown at us today. Just make sure you can build a wall with it later on.
It's interesting. And then, you know, you build a picture of, you know, someone who's incredibly determined, incredibly hardworking and very, very professional and successful. And what's the kind of, I don't know, the lighter side of you? What do your friends tease you about? What do your family kind of, what would they say if I said, what's your dad like? What would they say? And you'd say, no, it's not true, but maybe it is a bit true.
They'd say that I'm hard. They'd say that I'm difficult. They would say.
Difficult? In what way?
I believe that work comes first. I believe that work comes first. I don't think, for me, you know, you could perceive me as being a sad person because I don't really do anything for fun. You know, the only thing that I did do was I boxed myself and my son boxes. We had that time together where we boxed. And I'm very proud of him because, I'm very, proud of all of my children. They're making their own way in life.
Yeah.
They're doing okay. Do I give them any help? Yeah, of course I do. I try to give them, good advice. If they need loans to set businesses up, I'm happy to do so. But the money must be repaid.
Yeah.
Because what I don't want is if you don't, bringing children up is not an easy answer. It's not an easy, there's no book or guide to it. I personally think the best thing that my dad ever did for me is, which I try to do for my children, is be the advice they need. That's what I try to do.
And that by that you mean kind of leading by example?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, if you see your dad sleeping on the couch every day watching the TV, you assume that's the norm, don't you?
Yeah.
I saw my dad get up and go to work every day.
Yeah.
To me, that's the norm.
Yeah.
So
they'd say you're hard and difficult. Anything complimentary?
Anything complimentary, honestly.
Yeah.
I would say I think that they would say I've taken this out of the dark ages and put it on a road to light. And I believe it was.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it feels like maybe a good place to end things. What do you have next? What are your plans for the rest of the summer, for the winter? Are you travelling? Are you getting back out on the boat?
Yeah, look, because it's owned by the company, because it's a charter yacht, I have to even charter the yacht myself.
Yeah.
That's just how it is.
Yeah.
So what I look to do is, if there is availability, trust me, there's not a lot of availability. If there's 3 or 4 days, then I will then charter the yacht for those 3 days myself.
Yeah.
So that's what I try to do.
Okay. Well, I hope you do manage to get some time on it. And thank you very much for speaking to us.
Pleasure's been.
Thanks for listening to the Big Boat Interview, which is part of the Boat Briefing podcast. The programme is mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Tune in on Fridays to hear all the news from the world of super yachting and our special data reports, and don't forget to like and subscribe to make sure you never miss an episode. See you next time.